I'm Lindsay Herbert. I am the author of Digital Transformation, a new book that came out last year with Bloomsbury. And I'm also an inventor and a digital leader at IBM. I came to write Digital Transformation by working with organizations on programs that never started as digital transformation programs, as they often don't. They start as a website project that suddenly start to reveal cracks in the strategy and silos within the organization that stop you from being able to produce a cohesive picture of that organization on something like a website. So I'd been working on these types of projects that gradually started to be called digital transformation programs. And what I realized on a particular train journey when I was ruminating on a project that wasn't going smoothly, that I was creating a collection of common best practice and common worst practice that were leading to the same sorts of outcomes, regardless of whether it was a B2B firm or a charity that I was looking at. I was really excited by this idea of common best practice, common poor practice, especially in an area as scary as digital transformation. But I also knew that this was based only on my own experiences and my own observations. So I wanted to validate what I had come across. At the time, I was the global head of digital for a digital agency, and I knew that if I started approaching others outside, especially from other agencies or even on client side, that there might be the assumption that I'm trying to gather information on behalf of my company. And I didn't want that. I wanted this to be a pure exercise of understanding the right way of doing something challenging and then being able to share that information with as many people as possible. So on that same train journey, I decided that I should write a book, and that using the framework of a book, I could approach people from all walks of life, all different geographies, different sizes of organizations, get them to share their stories with me. I could share mine with them, and then I could distill it down into a framework that would be useful to others. So I got off the train, arrived at the event that I was speaking at, and I started introducing myself as, "Hi, I'm Lindsay, and I'm writing a book about digital transformation." And that's how it all began. What was so rewarding for me was right from my very first interview, which was someone I had met at that very conference, I started to realize that the best practice and the worst practice that I had identified, not only was it valid, but there were so many different techniques that people were using to make the most of the best practice and to rectify the problems of the bad, that there was easily enough material, even just from my first interview, to write a book. So then the challenge became how to distill it all down into something that Bloomsbury wouldn't panic at trying to publish. I think what's common to all organizations that face a digital transformation need is they have grown over a period of time. They've standardized things. They've put in place really great hierarchies. They've hired great people. They're doing everything the best of their ability as they've always been doing, but suddenly they're just not seeing the return that they used to be seeing. Not only are they not seeing the return, but they're also seeing changed behavior in their client base, their customer base, that they can't explain. It's easy to chalk up those problems to, oh, well, it's just a more competitive market out there, or customers aren't loyal anymore. But the more you dig into it, the more you realize that the feedback loops that you should be using to make decisions about whether what you're doing is correct for the impact you're trying to make, that those feedback loops, as a result of all that standardization and all those silos that have been created, they don't go outside the organization anymore. They circulate within the organization. That's where you get people who suddenly realize, wait a minute, what do our customers want? Do we believe what we're saying when we say we've got 30 years experience or 100 years experience, however long it might be within the organization, we know our customers best? And it's those people that start to challenge that assumption and start to travel outside of the organization, even if it's just something easy like going to conferences, and realize, whoa, no, guys, we're off base. There's a misalignment that started probably a long time ago. And now it's up to us to start to reestablish the correct feedback loops and the correct behaviors internally to deal with that feedback to be able to make those changes. That's what digital transformation really is at its root, and that's typically how it starts. Digital transformation means to become more adaptive to change itself. How you become adaptive to change and how you continue to adapt to change, it's leveraging, firstly, the ways of working that have been brought about by the innovation age, and that means using technology to be able to collaborate better, communicate better. The other part of it is understanding data and figuring out ways to use data correctly. when people start talking about data in the context of digital transformation, people think that data is the be-all, end-all. If you aren't set up to be able to analyze and interpret that data, you can have the biggest wealth of data in the world and actually be paralyzed into inaction because no one feels like they have the power within the organization to prioritize what piece of data should we really be paying attention to or pieces of data, and is the data that we've collected accurate? Or have we set up a process that's giving us false positives for something as critical as what our customers are looking for or what our clients need? So organizations that do adapting to change well, who are digitally transformed, are the ones that give a lot of accountability lower down in the organization, where people are able to not just interface directly with external users of the business, customers, clients, but also have their own objectives, not prescriptive tasks to complete, but objectives where they have the power to figure out how to meet those objectives themselves and have the power to collaborate with others to be able to meet those objectives. When I was interviewing people for the book, I found examples everywhere, whether it was Direct Line Group, where they started out being very risk-averse and siloed, as you would expect of most big organizations, but especially in the finance sector, to being able to support collaborative working models and have breakout projects and teams where by being given ways of working and being given a measurable outcome to achieve, that was enough to create a safe environment for some small-scale experimentation, exploration, and as the success metrics got proven out, be able to grow that. That starts with a single team, a project team. It doesn't need to be a big, giant, committee-led IT program, as people would normally expect. Everyone realizes that the best way of achieving any kind of transformation, big or small, is to start with something small, to have the right group of people collaborating on it, and to work on that piece, testing it with the people who are actually meant to be using it ultimately. And once you get that positive feedback, once you get those positive results, that's your sign to keep going and to keep putting investment and resource into it. One of my favorite examples of terrible, terrible practice, and it happens to be one of the most common practices, was an organization that I was working with. We were replatforming their entire digital estate. So everything from their mobile apps to their websites was being rebuilt. Very, very strict deadlines, very regimented process, program structure on the client side. Where the really bad practice came in was it was so regimented and hierarchical on the client side that the people who were the ultimate doers of the work, the developers, the designers, felt absolutely no ability to make decisions. They felt no sense of empowerment, and they also felt under a huge amount of time pressure, scrutiny, micromanagement. There was a major database that was being migrated over to a new system. It was going to have e-commerce functionality. So we were supposed to get dummy data to test out some of the functionality on a website that was a staging site, but publicly available because people from around the world were going to be using it and testing it. Completely non-secure, but that wasn't supposed to matter because it was going to be dummy customer data. And you can probably guess where this is going. The data that was uploaded due to a series of errors of who was responsible for handing and signing off things to whom ended up being real customer data. So for a period of about 3 months, real people's phone numbers, names, credit card details, everything was sitting unprotected, being used in trials, being used in testing, being accessed by people all over the world. And the saddest part at the end of it was that the developer in question, the one who ultimately pressed upload or activate, sensed that something was wrong because the data looked too good to be dummy data, but felt like he had not only no ability to say anything, but that if he didn't do the task that was dictated to him at the time, that would put his job at risk. So he had the knowledge and he had the foresight, but felt it was above his pay grade to flag something as basic as, hey, guys, I think we've got the wrong database here. I shut the project down. I put everything on pause. Everything got restructured. one of the key things that we said was we can't keep working like this. You've got some really great people who are the ones on the front line responsible for doing the work. Let's create project working groups where we've got senior stakeholders taking part in regular meetings, regular working sessions with people like the developers and the designers so that everyone's going to have a better sense of what work is actually getting done. But there are also going to be opportunities to improve on the requirements. One of the other problems with that project was that the requirements had been written over the course of an entire year. It was a 300-page document. And you can imagine with technology, within that year, the requirements had already fallen out of date. So if we hadn't stopped and restructured, and if that fatal error hadn't happened, and thank goodness nothing really terrible happened as a result of that, but if that all hadn't happened, they might have had a website and their digital estate up by their deadline or thereabouts, but it would have been the digital estate that they needed a year ago, not the one they needed today. I hate the term fail fast because it couldn't be any less accurate. The only real failure on an agile type project is if you don't learn anything. The real secret is to set things up so that you can learn from whatever experiment you run. The clients that I work with, whether I'm working with startups or whether I'm working with big corporates, I never say we are launching a product and don't worry because if it doesn't succeed, we can fail fast and recover. Instead, I say we're launching an experiment and we're going to gather some really useful insights, but let's make sure we're measuring the right things. One of my favorite quotes from one of the people I interviewed is, you measure what you treasure. So what matters most to us as a business or what matters most to the client's business, let's make sure that we've got key performance indicators, KPIs. Even if we're doing the little experiment with a closed group of customers that have been recruited specifically to test out something in its most embryonic state, so that when they react to that thing that we've created for them, we can turn their reactions into, did this pass the KPIs? Then you can start to understand how an organization, even if it's a really risk-averse organization, like the finance sector, where people are generally rewarded for being risk-averse, which makes it very unlikely for them to want to take a risk because they didn't get into a management position by taking risks, everyone can appreciate the value of an experiment and that experiment producing an outcome. Even if that outcome is, this is not a good approach, we need to take a different approach, well, now you actually have data that shows that that's not a good approach. You can stop discussing it. You can move on to look at something different. The real secret to success in any multidisciplinary team working on an iterative project is the members of that team itself and how much exposure they've had to other areas beyond just the status quo. So if you're trying to be innovative, the last thing you want is a bunch of people who haven't been outside the walls of that building for the last 30 years because they really only know what they've been doing and will naturally steer it back to familiar territory. So collaborating, having partnerships with external organizations, bringing in new staff, bringing in contractors, bringing in people who have a fresh take on things, allowing some of those people that have been in the organization for 30 years to go out and do something slightly different so that they can get that dose of inspiration of different ways of doing things, being able to come back in and apply those. That could be sending people on the right kind of conference. I was making a joke at an event I spoke at recently. If you work in the pensions industry and you only go to pensions conferences, then you're not really giving yourself a lot of fodder for innovation. So if you're going to go to a conference, make sure that it's the right one where you're going to get that kind of exposure. Also, make your goal not just to sit and listen to the speakers, but to talk to others and find out, are there people who are trying to achieve the same kind of goals that we are that maybe we could do a cross collaboration or a knowledge share with or a job shadowing with? That source of external inspiration could end up leading to bridges into other areas of expertise that you can then rely on when you need it for a particular project or an outcome that you're trying to achieve. My favorite story from the book by far, and definitely my favorite person to interview as well because of how great a storyteller he is, was Wim Phibbs. He was the managing director for the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, so the National Museum for the Netherlands. The museum had to close for a period of 10 years to undergo massive infrastructure renovations. And rather than letting go of all the staff and everyone going on a 10-year holiday, they decided that this was a major opportunity to not just transform the building, but to transform what a museum is and how it could be better delivering its mission, which is to bring the art and history of the Netherlands to the world. So the managing director did the first stage of digital transformation in my book, Bridge. He went out and started to explore all the other museums and galleries of the world, looking for inspiration. And the thing that he noticed straight away was that as soon as you walk into a gallery, you could tell when they'd had their last major injection of funding, because the technology in the space would immediately give away that if it was desktop computers, you had your funding in the 90s. If it was iPads, you had your funding in 2010. What he realized was that the thing that was the most off-putting when you walked into any of these galleries was the technology, because they actually got in the way of the real beauty, the genuine article that you were supposed to be visiting, that you traveled all that way to see. And that's when he had this epiphany that the last thing you want to do is put technology in a gallery space. Instead, how can technology better enable that mission of sharing the art and history with the world? That's when he had the idea that the Rijksmuseum should be the first in the world to put its collection entirely online, copyright free, for the world to be able to download and use. Sparked a long process for him to argue that and to get support for that. But in the end, not only was he successful, but they immediately saw other galleries and museums starting to follow suit. What it proved, and the argument that he was making over and over again internally, was that putting it all available online is not going to stop people from coming to see the real thing. Instead, people will be better informed, they'll be more excited, it'll be more meaningful for them when they see the real thing. One of the analogies he used is, just because we have Skype, does that mean we don't meet for a candlelit dinner anymore? And so for the people who will never have the means to get to the museum in person, we've achieved our mission statement with them now, because now they are enjoying the art and the history of the Netherlands, even if they can never physically come and enjoy it in person. Their visitation numbers were immediately up. The renovations, of course, were to accommodate a new crowd, a new type of visitor. Even with that, it was overwhelmed by the number of people who maybe had never heard of the Rijksmuseum before, but then saw one of the works of art in an ad for their favorite brand of yogurt on the side of a bus. And that was what inspired them to look online, find out where they could see the real article, and actually make the trip to Amsterdam. My top tips for digital transformation fit handily into an acronym called BUILD. It's the 5 stages for digital transformation. BUILD stands for Bridge, Uncover, Iterate, Leverage, and Disseminate. And I can take you through those right now. So the first is called Bridge. You go out, you get inspiration, and you start to make meaningful connections with people, with organizations that can help you get to where you need to be within your organization. And that helps you also define your vision of how you need to change, because you've now been inspired and you've also started to make those connections back with those customers that your organization was originally founded to serve. The second is to understand what your barriers and obstacles are within your organization. So you might have this great big vision. You might have lots of allies now outside who can help you achieve it. But if you don't uncover what those barriers are and start to put together plans to mitigate them, then you're ultimately just going to fall victim to them. Now, those barriers might be a lack of resource, or it just might be a general fear and aversion to change within the culture of the organization. Stage 3 in the book is iterate, because you want to be able to put together a small project where you're giving people a safe space to try something, test it out with real users, have some measurable results, and it's those measurable results that you then can use to gain more space, more resource to do more. And the more successful you are, the more results you have. And then before you know it, you're not trying to convince people to change. People are knocking on your door asking for your help so that they can start to change in their area as well. And that goes on to the next step, which is leverage. So you leverage those successes. Morgan Stanley is an example from the book where they entered their new website to win a Webby Award. and they won the Webby Award. And the reason they did it is they knew it would give them huge credibility internally, because to be recognized in the finance sector for doing well with innovation is one thing. To be recognized in the public domain for doing well with innovation, that made them experts. The last step in the book is disseminate. How you get others working in this way or thinking in this way. And it's by going right back to the very start of the model with Bridge and bringing them in and working together and having champions of certain ways of working who can join other projects and show others how it's done. A little extra tip on top of that, I would say the worst thing that you can do to disseminate innovation is training sessions. I personally hate training sessions, and I think that they actually lead to people being disgruntled about change, because you get them into a training group, they get all excited about new ways of working, they finish their training, they go back to their desks, they're hit with all the usual stuff they have to do, they have no idea how to make the training apply the scenario that they're in, and it makes them feel like this new wonderful way of working and doing things is happening in another part of the organization, but they don't feel they're allowed to participate in it. The way that I got into the world of digital and became a technology expert is that I followed curiosity and I sought opportunities, and I realized, and I'll use a quote from IBM CEO, which is that growth and comfort don't coexist. If you feel comfortable in your job and you don't feel like there's a scary challenge that you're trying to overcome, then you're probably letting some big opportunity slip by that's going to come back to bite you in a couple of years' time. So if someone's really worried about technology doing them out of a job or being left behind the curb, then pursue every opportunity to learn more, get involved more, join the project that you don't feel you have the expertise for now, but chances are nobody in that project is really an expert, and everyone is doing this test and learn approach. That's how you become an expert. I started as a print journalist, and now I'm a technology leader in IBM. So you can't get much different in terms of my formal credentials matching my what is now expertise. But that's been built on almost 20 years of testing and learning in the technology space. And now I work with AI, I work with blockchain. These are technologies that didn't exist when I did my training as a print journalist. So I couldn't have done anything different when I was in university. I had to take this route to be where I am today.